Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we're your hosts. Glad to have you back with us for another week of fun and excitement. My name is Chris Sims. With me, as always, my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, witness me.
I am indeed witnessing you.
Thank you.
It has been a big week, and we are going to talk about what a big week it has been very shortly. But before we get to our huge news, we're going to be talking to a guest with some huge news.
Yeah.
And that is Janelle Aslin, the editor of Fresh Romance, which was successfully funded on Kickstarter. Three really great stories in there. That's going to be a fun time. And then we've also got this huge news, the news that revolves around our newest Patreon supporters.
Now, Matt, are we talking about people who have gone to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kicked in at least $1 a month to help keep the lights on here at Ajax HQ and help us pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills?
You have accurately described the situation.
is that the most accurate summary of our relationship with these very kind people?
They help us with those gimmicks in the mail they call bills.
There's a level of disdain when you say it that is absent when I say it.
I love calling everything a gimmick.
Last year when I went to King of Trios, and I was hanging out with Kyle Starks and Kieran Chiak, by the end of that weekend, everything was a gimmick. Everything.
Can you give me
hand me that gimmick full of water. Thanks.
Give me that gimmick out of the fridge. All right, here are our Patreon supporters. We do appreciate them. Tom Zilla.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Dave Barbella.
Thank you, Dave. That's your middle name.
That is. Genevieve Paquin Psycali.
Oh, thank you, Genevieve.
There's going to be some names that I'm going to mangle in this group. I'll just tell you right now. Callum Smith.
Oh, thank you, Callum. That's a name I recognize as a longtime listener.
Robert Petremu.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
I hope I got his name right. Andrew Marquez.
Thank you, Andrew.
And that's it. Those are our newest Patreon patrons. Patrons? Patrons?
Patron. The planet from which all Transformers emerge.
It's the planet of Patreon, Patron. We do thank them so much for their support. We appreciate them. And they are some of our favorite people. Now, Chris, that we have expressed that appreciation and adoration, it's time to do some checks and wrecks. So let's do that. So come on, tickety-tack yourself before you wreck yourself. Chris, big week. I assume a big check is on the way.
Yeah, for me. My check this week is that the first chapter of X-Men 92, which, of course, is called Hope You Survived the Experience. Because, honestly, what else were we going to call it? That is available now on Comixology and whichever way you read your digital Marvel comics. A lot of people have been saying very, very nice things about it. I mentioned last week, I am constantly a wreck this week as this was getting ready to come out. Chad has read some very nice reviews and told me about them. Chad has read some very, very nice things people were saying online about it. Everybody seems to like that opening scene with Jubilee a lot, which was very, very fun to write. If you have picked it up and you did enjoy it, thank you. If you picked it up and you did not enjoy it, I'm sorry. It's going to get a lot weirder, so be on the lookout for that if you plan on continuing to read it. I'm really glad that first chapter is out. We worked really hard on it. We're continuing to work really hard on it. I'm doing some Rogue and Gambit dialogue, which is the most fun thing to write. That is what I've been writing this week, and it's so great. There's so much "I can't touch your Remy's" in there.
I picked it up. I read it, I thought that the scene transitions, the stuff that Scott Koblish did, special for digital, were really, really well done. It had the feel of the show, the cartoon show.
The cartoon show that it's definitely not based on.
That it's definitely not based on. But it definitely had that feel. Even with, you know, Senator Kelly coming in on a space chariot from Doctor Doom. You know, even with the obvious Secret Wars stuff that's going on in there, I think there was just enough Secret Wars in it. But all the set pieces from, you know, a big activity that the team all does together to the, you know, the briefing scene with Professor X to going to some brand new facility to meet the leader of it and kind of liaison with them had that era X-Men feel like right down to a T. And Koblish's art is just so perfect for it. It's so good.
Yeah,
My jaw was open throughout as I kept looking at how good his art was.
It was actually Scott's birthday today, and I told him, you know, when I found his birthday, I was like, "Hey, happy birthday!" Chad and I have said this in interviews, but like working with you has been a revelation. You know, I have been lucky enough to work with amazing artists: Rusty, Matt Diggs, Matthew Bramble, Erica, who is obviously had some really great news this week, announced as the artist of Chip Zdarsky's run on Jughead. That's going to be amazing. You know, Steve Downer, Joe Hunter, like those are all artists that I've really, really loved working with. Scott Kowalczyk. But the stuff, you know, getting to see the stuff that Koblish is doing with just the pure storytelling of it, that, you know, we're doing it Marvel style, and so he gets the plot and all of the breakdowns, all of the pacing, that's all him. Just as a dude who likes reading comics, it is amazing to see that guy work. He is phenomenal. If you have not checked out any of this stuff, well, I mean, obviously I would like it if you checked out X-Men 92, but do yourself a favor and go hunt down some of what Scott's been doing on, like, the Deadpool books. He is phenomenal and just an absolute pleasure to work with. Check his stuff out. Again, preferably X-Men 92. If you're a fan of this show and you're a fan of the stuff that I've written about the X-Men in the past and the X-Men comics that I read growing up, I think you'll enjoy it. I think my favorite quote is there was a review on CBR that called it the best Pizza Hut X-Men comic, which, and I have said this in interviews, that's what we're going for. Those four Pizza Hut X-Men comics are the exact tone that we wanted to set with this book. So I'm very, very excited about it, and I'm glad to see a lot of people enjoy it.
It's the same tone as those Pizza Hut X-Men books with, and look, no offense to the artists on those Pizza Hut X-Men books. Exponentially better art.
Yeah, Koblish is a beast. Koblish is ridiculously good. I'm really still very, you know, there's still a lot of anxiety about it. It's obviously a pretty big thing because people sure do like those X-Men. And Matt, you don't know how much people like the X-Men. You do not know until they say, "Hey, this person's writing the X-Men. Please send your complaints." Matt, what were you up to this week?
I was in the process of making a video and otherwise setting up a Kickstarter that is going to be launching on the day that this episode of War Rocket Ajax goes up.
That's right. Oh, that's exciting.
On June 1st, the day that this episode is posted, there is going to be a brand new Kickstarter for a print trade paperback of Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective. Here's why. Nobody wanted it. I shopped it around to lots of publishers. I got very nice responses about people saying that they liked it, but also that they could not publish it, either because it's black and white or because it's a little too niche-y, robot noir that's kind of set in a weird alternate future from the, like, what people imagined the future was in the 30s and 40s. not exactly a broad audience kind of thing, necessarily, but I have gotten a lot of nice response to the notion of doing a Kickstarter. And we didn't do that bad on Comixology or Monkey Brain. We did all right digitally. So I don't have any real hesitations that that Kickstarter is going to do badly. I could be proven wrong. But I've had quite a few people say, I really want a print version of Copernicus Jones. It looks great in print. The artist, Kevin Warren, actually got one copy for him and one copy for me printed up. It looks so good on the page. And so we're going to be doing a Kickstarter to do that trade paperback. If you would like to get a copy of that trade paperback, it's $15 on the Kickstarter. You can go check that out on Kickstarter right now, more or less. I think I'm going to launch it around noon, the same time that this episode goes up. I had a lot of fun making the video. My wife Marlene and I both are in it. I made a very, very short noir film of my own to start off, and then there's a little bit of description about the book and what we're trying to do with it and what we're doing with the Kickstarter after that in the video, so definitely watch the video on the page. And then this is some great news. We're going to have a foreword by none other than Greg Rucka.
Friend of the show.
On the book. Friend of the show, awesome writer, one of my heroes, someone I admire so much, wrote one of the best crime comics, several of the best crime comics in comics history. So I could not be more excited about that. And then we've got some stretch goals that are really cool. Guest art from our friend Jordan Witt, our friend Kyle Starks, our friend Joe Hunter. That could all end up in the book if we reach certain stretch goals. Some process stuff, a two-page story by Kevin could be in there. And the script's going to be in there if we reach a particular stretch goal. So this is something I've been wanting to do for a long time. I would love to sell trade paperbacks of Copernicus Jones at cons, but I also just want to get out trade paperbacks to people who will be kind enough to back this Kickstarter. So this kind of kills two birds with one stone on that. It will make a trade paperback exist. So I'll put a link to it in the show notes. If you like Copernicus Jones, if you've got some of the digital issues, or if you're not a person, if you're a person who was interested in the book but wasn't really into digital, here's your chance to read this comic I did, the first arc, the first six issues.
Now, Matt, you are kickstarting it this week, today, launching today. So I'm going to assume, I know the answer to this question, but I just want to ask anyway, you're not going to have these on the table at HeroesCon this year.
They will not be on the table at HeroesCon. So if you want to pick one up at a convention, that won't be till next year. If you want to get one this year, before probably sometime in the fall, most likely, then definitely help us out on Kickstarter. It's going to last the entire month of June. So that's going to be June 1st through June 30th. That is what's been going on with me. I've been deep in the Kickstarter mines, making a Kickstarter.
Working in them Kickstarter mines, just like your daddy before you.
Okay, let's make some recommendations. Chris, I think we may end up sharing a recommendation this week, or we're going to take the full recommendation time.
My main recommendation last week was Furious 7, because it is the finest film of our generation, and the Oscars will be renamed the Diesels in our lifetimes because of it. But I wanted to basically cede my recommendation time this week so that you and I could have a conversation.
About Mad Max Fury Road. Now, I said last week that I was going to be going to see that movie the day after we recorded that episode, and so it happened. I really, really liked it. Had the most amazing action sequences I've seen in a movie in I don't know how long. My tweet immediately after I saw the movie was that is there a stunts Oscar? If there is, can Fury Road be awarded all of them retroactively?
Yeah, and it, you know, you can go into that movie hearing, you know, hey, it's 90% practical effects and 10% CGI. And then you don't really get that until you see, like, the pictures of, like what they shot out in the desert and then what it looks like on film. And it's like, yeah, the giant truck covered in skulls exploding is real. They just CGI'd in like three dirt bikes around it.
Yeah, all the stuff where people are swinging around on poles, on moving vehicles, they did that.
The action in that movie feels real. It feels dangerous in a way. There is a thoughtfulness and a reality put into the action in that movie that is amazing.
I actually, there's like a certain degree of like trying to maintain continuity for Max that is so admirable, but also like totally unnecessary. Like, I admire it, but like so many people watching that movie are not going to care at all. But his jacket is Max's jacket. Yeah. That is the Mad Max car. And what's really crazy about that being the Mad Max car is that it does not survive the movie.
It doesn't survive the opening scene.
Well, no, it's there later in the movie.
I do love the only things Max says for like 45 minutes of that movie is just literally grumbling things like, that's my fucking jacket.
Yeah, that's my jacket. Hey, you almost shot me. Watch it. Two things about like the opening parts of that movie. Okay, here's the one thing I didn't like so much about the movie. Like, if the stunts were really great, the sound editing was surprisingly not.
That is really shocking to me because I thought the sound design in that movie was amazing. Maybe I thought it was noticeably amazing.
Maybe it's just like the theater I saw it in with that particular sound mix.
I was such a big fan of the way that the score would blend into the, you know, the sound of the big drums and amps. I loved that, like, every time there was a gunshot next to Max's head, you'd get the ears ringing sound.
That stuff was fine. Like, that stuff I was totally great with. Like, some of the sound design. But the sound editing where, especially when Tom Hardy talks, like, he must have said every line at such a low volume on the set. Because everything,
he does a lot of mumbling.
Everything sounds ADR'd. And at certain times, it's, like, really noticeably, like, just doesn't fit. Like, there's one time in particular near the beginning when he's strapped to the front of the car. And one of the war boys shoots by his head. And he, like, turns around and he goes, "That's my head!" And it seems off and weird. The music and stuff is fantastic. And the fact that that music is like really being played on vehicles, like according to the guy who plays Doof Warrior, who is the guitar player in the movie, that guitar was actually terrible, but he was really playing it.
Well, it does shoot fire. And it also shoots fire for real.
Yes. I loved how much Furiosa was the driving force, literally and figuratively.
You get to a point where you kind of figure out how her entire character is structured. And I want to say it's in casual conversation, but it's definitely not a casual conversation. But it is about, you know, 30 seconds of people talking to each other when it all clicks into place. It's like, okay, this was not an impulsive thing for her. Like, this was not something she decided after meeting with Immortan Joe's wives. Like, this is a thing she has been planning for a very, very long time.
And the wives have been in on the plan for quite some time as well. They planned it out even with Art.
Yes.
She is the character who goes on a hero's journey. And I think that is fantastic. The people who have complained about how, like, this movie is a stealth, like, gives us a stealth woman as a protagonist kind of story when it's called Mad Max and should feature Mad Max, it doesn't feel like they've seen the other Mad Max movies, because the only one where he really has that arc is the first one.
The funniest comment from some angry dude was, clearly the people who made this movie have never seen the other Mad Max films. It's like, really? You mean writer and director of all four Mad Max films?
You mean George Miller?
Yeah, because it's the same dude. It's the same guy.
Like, The thing about, like, go back and watch Road Warrior and Beyond Thunderdome. He's Ronin. He's the man with no name.
I had a great conversation last night with Ben Gully, who's a good friend of ours, Jordan Witt, and Rachel Edidin. On all of us really liked the movie. And one of the things I said was that there were two Georges making movies in the late 70s who really fucking loved Akira Kurosawa.
And that is very true. That is kind of the status of Max's character, right? Like, he's just the sort of wandering hero who comes in and helps, but he's not the person driving the action. He just kind of gets thrown into it. That is especially true of this movie.
Yes.
Where he is an unwilling participant for much of it.
For most of it.
Yeah. Somebody described his arc in this movie as regaining his humanity. And I think that's a really interesting and thoughtful way to put it. Like, the moment where he allows Furiosa to take the shot on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Is like, that has, there's nothing said there, but there's a level of trust there that they have not previously had until that point in the movie.
Well, there's a piece of the beginning of the movie. You know, it makes sense. And again, I have not seen the other Mad Max movies in years. Jordan actually did what I said I wanted to do. Like, she liked it so much that she went and got Mad Max, Road Warrior, and Beyond Thunderdome, and is like watching them all this week, and then going to see Fury Road again. The opening of that movie, where he talks about survival, and that is the one thing he is focused on for the entire movie. He is just motivated by survival until he hits a point where he accepts that there is something greater than that. He is driven to it by past experiences.
Yeah.
That are painful for him to acknowledge, which I think is, and none of that is ever, like, there's a voiceover at the beginning about survival, but none of that other stuff is ever said, and he is a very quiet character.
For a movie that is so over the top with its insane action sequences, insane car chase, insane stunts, it is a very understated movie in a way that I really enjoy.
It's a very 70s movie in a lot of ways, in that there's a lot of quietness mixed with a lack of subtlety. This is a movie that, if you haven't seen it, I'm sure you've talked about people, or I'm sure you've heard about people talking about how feminist it is and how that message is very much up front. And by that, they mean that the words, "we are not things," are literally written in giant white letters by the women in the cast. Yeah. But there's also a lot of really subtle commentary on you know, the way that people are manipulated into throwing their lives away, and about toxic masculinity. Like, there's a lot of really cool stuff going on in there that is simultaneously right in front of you and also done in a really subtle manner, I think. Character arcs are really kind of subtle in that movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, even Furiosa's, like she has that moment of, like, realizing that her journey, the dream that she was journeying to, isn't what she was expecting, and that changes her. Like, the way she reacts to things after that is different, and she almost has that, like, re-embracing of humanity moment too.
And the scene where that happens, Charlize Theron is an amazing actress, because if she wasn't, that scene would have been terrible.
It would have been really cheesy.
She's so good.
All the stuff with her arm is great. I knew that she was missing an arm from, like, stuff before this, but there was kind of this moment where I was like, oh, right, she doesn't have an arm. She's missing an arm. Where you just kind of, like, really notice it in one part. And then in that scene where she has that, like, big emotional moment, the arm just kind of falls off. The mechanical arm just kind of falls off. It's really, really nicely done.
And also, literally everything that is set up in that movie pays off.
Yes. All the war boy stuff, which I kept wanting to call them fuck boys. Because of Run the
Jewels. That would have been a little too on the nose.
Probably. Because of Run the Jewels.
A little too unsubtle.
By the way, Immortan Joe, two things about Immortan Joe, the villain of this movie, who is really, like, incredibly creepy looking to the point of it being nuts. But one, his water distribution system grossly inefficient.
Incredible. There was an entire article on the Toast about that.
And then, well, the one thing that bugged me at the end of the movie is they didn't fix it. They just turned it on.
Yeah, I'm sure it's like, look, it's on the to-do list.
Build some pipes, guys. You can build these souped up cars. You can build some goddamn pipes. And two, what a master of branding that guy is.
Yeah. He had that shit carved into stone.
Like, figuratively and literally. Like, he actually brands people. But, yes. But in terms of, like, man, he puts that logo on everything.
That logo is everywhere.
He is capitalist with a capital C.
There's one sort of tangentially related thing, and I don't think you and I have talked about it yet. I've talked about it with a couple of other people. Have we talked about the upcoming Mad Max video game?
We have not.
Okay. It's coming out later this year, so I don't think it's quite the we're doing a Mad Max movie, let's rush a tie-in game out that it might seem like. It's coming from Warner Brothers Interactive. It's coming out in October, I think. I think it's just called Mad Max because the website is just madmaxgame.com or whatever. But yeah. I think Ben Gulley said that he heard it referred to as Thunder Road or something. Like,
no, that's what it's called. It's called Thunder Road.
Is it called Thunder Road? Okay.
Yes.
Have you seen anything about it?
I've seen some like interview stuff, but I haven't seen like screenshots or video from it or anything like that.
All right. Now, I went and watched the video they had, like the gameplay video on the site, because we have both probably been in a very Mad Max-y mood. Like, I almost started playing Fallout again just because I want to scrounge for ammo.
If you want to play a great kind of variation on a Mad Max game, go find the 1990s, like late 90s PC adventure game Full Throttle.
Oh, yeah. I know about the Full Throttle. But I'm watching this video. We all know better than to get excited about gameplay videos from 6 months before a video game comes out. But this game looks to have the Arkham combat engine, but with Mad Max. And also you drive around in cars, wrecking other cars and stealing stuff off of them to improve your car.
I mean, that
and scrounging through the wasteland.
That sounds pretty great.
I know I'm going to be disappointed by it. Like, I know I am. It is almost a foregone conclusion. But, like, if that game actually is the combat from Arkham City plus driving around the wasteland in a fucked-up custom car plus, like, that early Fallout scrounging for ammo and, like, desperately trying to survive, you know, the same thing that you get out of the early game in Fallout and the early game in Tomb Raider 2013. Like, if it actually is that, I am kind of excited about it, and I hope it is, and I hope...
I mean, look, the only way I could be super, super excited about a Mad Max game would be if I knew it was a Telltale game. Right? But
yeah, but you don't get to drive around in those games, do you?
And Sam and Max, you do. I hope that this Mad Max game could be good. Before we
That's all I have to say about it.
Before we wrap up talking about the movie, I do want to say one thing. As we were leaving the movie, Marlene and I got to talk, like, Marlene really liked it too. We got to talking about, like, the feminist message of the movie, or, like, the feminist stuff that's in it. And I think if you're going into it expecting it to be this super feminist movie, you may be a little disappointed in it because it's not exactly a feminist manifesto and it's not revolutionary.
Yeah, Aiden was the same way. Like, my girlfriend was really. Like, we came out of the theater having very, like, with me just going, like, I really like that, and her being really disappointed by it.
Well, I think you can build up your expectations of that way too much, especially with the kind of hyperbolic things people have been saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, it's a movie that has a female protagonist, and it uses some women characters in ways that you might not expect. But otherwise, it kind of fits those slots of, like, male antagonist, you know, male title character who is also a protagonist. All the war boys are guys. To get to that, like, really super feminist super movie, the movie would have to be Furiosa's a woman, Max is a woman, all the villains are women, and the people who are kidnapped are men.
I did read that when they were writing the movie, they ended up with enough material for I think they said two additional movies in addition to what they like cut out and made Fury Road, yeah. And that one of them was a Furiosa movie. And I would love to see the post-apocalyptic robot arm Charlize Theron movie. Like, yeah. I would be 1,000,000% into that.
Me too. Like, I am ready for a Charlize Theron-driven action movie right now.
Yes.
Like, another one. Because...
But yeah, I feel like it's very easy to see people's reactions to it and get your hopes up maybe a little higher than they should be, but also I still really, really like that
yes,
movie a lot.
I'm not saying that the movie fails. I'm saying it's not the feminist revolutionary movie that people say it is.
Yeah, I think you're probably correct.
Marlene got it right when we came out of that and she said, "You don't think a woman can be the lead of an action movie? Watch that movie."
Yeah.
That will prove you wrong. Yeah. But
and I'm so glad that movie is doing well.
Yeah,
I'm so glad that it is has been critically well received and seems to be very successful.
That's our long rec segment about one movie, but we have a lot to say about it. It's good.
Look, we wanted to give everybody 3 weeks to see it.
If you haven't seen it yet, go see Mad Max for sure. All right, now we've got to get to our interview segment. We have the pleasure of getting
to Matt,
our interview.
It's time for us to review comic books.
Oh damn! Oh no! Well, let's knock that out quick. I know we wanted to talk about Convergence number 8, but we don't want to say too much about it. We don't want to say too many bad things, but this is a bad comic.
I don't really want to say a lot about Convergence number 8, because when you get right down to it, I am currently writing something that is more or less a competitor to Convergence. You know, I'm writing part of Marvel's Summer Big Event. I mean, a very small ancillary part, but still. The one thing that I will say is that there is a section in this book where pre-Flashpoint Superman, pre-Final Night Parallax-ass Hal Jordan, and pre-Crisis Barry Allen and pre-Crisis Supergirl all have to like team up and go back in time and stop something. That literally lasts one panel. Like, they leave... And in the upper left corner of the panel, Barry Allen says, "Let's go save the multiverse." And in the lower right-hand corner of that same panel, someone says, "Yep, they did it." And I would have loved to have seen that team as the focus of Convergence going around doing stuff.
Here's another thing that happens in this comic. Brainiac, who, as far as we knew, was dead. Like, Deimos had killed him. But on a whim, he's just brought back, has a change of heart all in one page. The change of heart goes from, "I want to destroy you," to, "Now I'm going to save you all and send you back home."
That's five panels.
Because I'm sad. You know what? It turns out I'm not angry, I'm sad. That's what he says. Not in those terms exactly, but that is what is expressed. He has clearly been planning this whole Convergence thing where he was going to make these people come fight for a very long time. And then on a dime, he decides he doesn't want to do it anymore. And he's going to send everybody home. There is nothing that drives him to this conclusion. He just does it. Because now the book's got to end. The really galling thing is how all of Convergence is just an excuse to change the old multiverse into the new multiverse from Multiversity. It provides an explanation for why Earth 12 is not an old Earth 12, it's a new Earth 12. Totally unnecessary. They can just change the multiverse whenever they want to. It's not real, it's fictional. They can do that.
We have the Multiversity guidebook that covers a lot of the information. Convergence ended up being a weird parallel story to Multiversity. And I remember, I think I said on the show, how odd I thought it was that Convergence and Multiversity were happening at the same time. And I feel like the way that they end up tying together with the ultimate end of Convergence being going and resetting the universe to be the Multiversity multiverse is an even weirder way to go about things.
Yeah.
It's a really strange book. I also feel like Matt and I could do an hour on Convergence number 8. Easily.
Three more quick things and we'll be done. One, okay. there's a part in this where Telos name checks Countdown and Zero Hour by name and says it to people as if they'll understand it. He mentioned Zero Hour to Hal Jordan, like Hal Jordan just knows what that is.
Yeah, and the weird thing, like, there's this weird line in comic books, and I think you see it a lot, like, when it's done well, like, there have been scenes where you see, like, the hallway of the Daily Planet, right? And there'll be, like, all the big issues of the Daily Planet. And the big issues of the Daily Planet are obviously covering the big issues of, you know, like, the big events that happened in that universe. So there'll be one that says, The Death of Superman, and that's the headline. And there'll be one that says, Final Night. And that's, you know, that makes sense. Zero Hour, A Crisis in Time. I don't feel like that was the headline of the paper that day.
Yeah. There's a scene where Hal Jordan kills Demos in issue 7. Superman is super cool with hanging out with him and going back in time with him to Crisis on Infinite Earths. Also, it's stated outright that Crisis on Infinite Earths is such an important story that they can't undo it. It has to happen. So that's why, you know, pre-Crisis Superman, like all the characters that are pre-Crisis, have to go be in the Crisis.
Except that's not pre-Crisis Superman, that's pre-Flashpoint Superman.
I don't know.
And Hal Jordan's not in Crisis. And also, if Crisis can't be undone, Crisis ended the multiverse and this brought back the multiverse. Look, we could do an hour.
All right, let's talk about...
A lot of great comics came out of Convergence.
Well, let's talk about one of those. Let's talk about Convergence Shazam number 2. And we liked that Question series, we liked that Atom series, but if there's one shining gem that came out of Convergence, it is this Shazam two-parter. And I've seen so many people telling Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner that they have to keep doing Shazam comics after this. And I am 100% on board with that. DC Comics, learn this lesson. Give them a Shazam book. Like, this issue is a really insane mashup with Gotham by Gaslight Batman. Doc Shaner does an amazing job with that shit. Where he's doing some Mike Mignola-style art. He does, like, these great versions of Batman villains in a Gotham by Gaslight way. And then Mr. Adam shows up, and that shit is crazy good.
I love Mr. Adam. Mr. Adam's great.
Oh, man. The stuff with Mr. Adam, top shelf, top notch. And it does that thing. It does that Shazam thing where even after this bananas story ends, it ends with the Marvel family flying up into the clouds and smiling. How crazy is it that two really, really wonderful, classic Captain Marvel Shazam stories came out this year and are some of the best comics that came out this year?
He's a great character. He's one of the best. He's a better idea than Superman.
Doc Shaner drawing him? Amazing. Cameron Stewart drawing him? Amazing. You just have to get really great artists on this stuff, and they will do it for you, man. They will make it happen.
There was a post going around Tumblr a couple weeks ago, and it was Cameron Stewart's designs and Doc Shaner's designs for Thunderworld and for Convergence Shazam. And it's like, they're both equally perfect.
Yeah.
Like, they're both like, yep, this is what he looks like.
They're so good. You can tell that we're short on time because I almost skipped the comic segment entirely. So we're just going to cut it at 2. And we're going to move on to our interview segment with Janelle Aslan.
Joining us for the program this week is one of our bosses, actually. You will know her from her position as one of the editors at Comics Alliance, but you will also know her as the founder of Rosie Press, the company that is putting out the kickstarted Fresh Romance anthology, the first issue of which just hit digital last week. It's a brand new, fantastic romance comic anthology. Janelle Salen is here. Janelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you because even though you're one of the editors of Comics Alliance, we do not actually talk to each other that often. So
that is true. Your articles just appear.
Yeah, that's true. They just no work is involved. They just show up like magic. Thanks. What's really interesting to me about Fresh Romance, aside from the content, which obviously we're going to get to talk about, it's romance focused. It's got a variety of really great stories in it. I liked all three of them in the first issue. But what really struck me about it is that the day job of all three of us is we work in comics criticism. You know, we write reviews, we write jokes, we write about things going on in the comics industry. And Matt and I are also in a position where we're making comics. You know, we're writing comics, we're doing self-published stuff. You decided you were going to found a company and put out a romance anthology. And that, to me, that is a big thing to go about doing. And I know you have editorial experience in working in superhero comics as well, but how did that decision come about?
Some years ago, while I was still at DC, so in 2010, I started getting my master's in publishing at Pace University in New York. And it was an interesting master's program because it was mostly focused on the business. Like, it wasn't a creative program. It was technically a master's of science. So it was very much about the business of publishing. And I had classes about contracts and accounting and things like that. As part of that, I just started thinking more and more about the idea of running my own business. And, you know, a lot of the projects that we had to do for school were about creating a list and running a company, because that was the easiest way for them to really get us to wrap our heads around some of the concepts. And I really liked that. My dad has run his own business for over 40 years now, and he and my mom own a store now. And, you know, I sort of grew up with the idea that running your own business was a normal thing and sort of preferable to any sort of corporate rat race, I guess. As I became sort of dissatisfied with working at larger companies and the frustrations of trying to get things made when there are 18 cooks in every kitchen, it just, starting my own company seemed more and more appealing. So eventually I just started figuring out how I can make that happen.
I have one very silly question, and I'm going to follow up that up with a very serious question.
Okay.
My very silly question is about the name of the company, Rosie Press. What made you decide to name your company after the multi-talented actor, dancer, host? She's a triple threat, if not more. The wonderful Rosie Perez.
You know, that never occurred to me until we went public, and then a bunch of people are like, is Rosie Perez going to be your spokesperson? I was like, oh, I was so focused on making sure no publishers had this name that it didn't occur to me that it sounded like that.
It had not occurred to me. And now it's all I can think. So thank you for...
First thing that came into my head, partially because my wife does a Rosie Perez impression that's really funny. But there's a... What was the... Other than just like having a name that nobody else had, is there a story behind that name?
Sort of a couple different things. You know, I had... For both the magazine title and the company name, I had sort of made a list of a bunch of different options of things that might work. And for a while, I was really focused on, I can't even remember what it was now, because Rosie Press has so erased it from my mind, but I was thinking about having the company be named the Gaelic word for love. Everyone I talked to about it was like, so that's original. No one's going to know how the hell to pronounce it. And I was like, well, on the one hand, I'm used to that because no one can pronounce my last name. But I realized, like, as I had to explain it over and over and over, like, oh, yeah, this isn't going to work. I need something way simpler than that. But also, Rosie is the name of my niece and was my grandmother's nickname. So it's sort of a family name, although the spelling is amended for the company. And I just thought it's a slightly romantic name in that, you know, like roses are associated with romance without being like really sort of ridiculously overtly romantic.
Yeah, it's not breathy kiss comics.
Right.
it's not spicy books.
Wait, does anyone have that? Because I will. I'll start spicy books right now.
My very serious question is about what you think of when you think of the job of an editor-in-chief or an executive editor, because I think there's an image that the title of editor puts across. Editor, to a lot of people, is just a copy editor, a person who looks at text and edits text, right? I know there's so much more to that job, especially when it comes to comics. And the fact that you describe it as more business than creative is really interesting to me. I know there's a lot of creative stuff behind what you're doing, but I just wanted to hear from you what you consider your job description to be.
It's interesting because, you know, of course, my position at Rosie Press is so different from any other editorial role I've had because I do everything. Like, I'm doing the accounting. I'm paying everyone. I'm cutting the checks. I'm logging all the sales in and tracking sales and crunching the numbers. And that's not necessarily a normal part of an editor's life. I got an email today from a woman who was a little flustered because she needed to reset her password. And it had taken like a little too long for me to get back to her. It took like more than 12 hours. And I wrote back to her and was like, I'm sorry, like this is a one person company. And she was like, oh, I had no idea. And I'm like, yeah, it's just me also answering all the help emails and like everything. So for me, it's like everything that is involved with running the publishing company, I do it. And that means, you know, I formulated the contracts with my lawyer and I have to deal with all the contracts with my lawyer. And I, for every issue, I have to plan out what is going into it. And that includes the comic stories, but it also includes all the extra content. I'm hiring people to write articles that will go in between different stories. Like issue two, we're going to have a look at the fashion of vintage romance comics written Jackie Nodell, who has a blog about vintage romance comics. So she's going to analyze it and talk about it, and that should be really neat. Planning all that, it's planning each issue, but then it is copy editing. But I also, like, I hire a proofreader because I'm not the best proofreader in the world. And even though it's like part of the job, I don't enjoy it. So if I can throw somebody a little bit of money and not have to do it, that saves me a bunch of time. So yeah, it's keeping all the trains running, making sure everybody has their deadlines and knows when everything needs to be done by. And it's interesting because for my website, like, we have way more time, but in terms of making sure it's up on Comixology, we have to be done about 3 weeks before we want the issue to be live. So it's just sort of keeping everyone on track so that we make sure Comixology has enough time to do all their magic.
The fact that you have a master's in publishing, but like, the fact that you knew to go talk with a lawyer about these contracts, I think means that you... You are one of, like, the four people in indie comics who knows of anything about business. Like, Matt will tell you, when we were doing company stuff just for Ajax, I was like a child. Like, I find that stuff to be so intimidating and genuinely frightening.
Oh, I love it.
Do you really? Is it like, because yeah. I imagine that it has, like, there is a level of challenge to it that I imagine is very rewarding because, you know, you are the one organizing it all and getting all the, you know, you're the one who gets to read all the stories as they come in and put them all together.
Oh, yeah. It's even at DC, some of the stuff I loved the most was, like, doing the paperwork and making sure everything was, like, filled out correctly. So that's part of what I like about being an editor is I enjoy the creative parts, but for me, it's more about the business parts. And, I mean, I had people who are sadly high up in comics publishing laugh in my face when I explained that I was getting my master's and then say, why are you doing that? You work in comics.
Yeah, that's a wow. pretty, that's a summary of the industry.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, I do think though, like, I could not be more opposite in my view of that stuff. Cause as Chris was saying, like, I did a lot of setting up business stuff just for podcasting and, like, boy, give me a 10,000 word document to proofread any day of the week, but put like a tax form in front of me and I crumple to the ground. Like, I can't, I don't know what's going on.
And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to reinforce the image of us as, you know, men children any more than I think we already have. But that stuff's scary because if you get it wrong, it's illegal. Like, you can go to jail. That's how they got Capone.
Yeah, in fact, just tonight I sent my lawyer like an email full of questions about filling out a copyright form because I'm like, I want to make sure I don't screw any of this up, but, you know, I want to make sure it's done. And so, but yeah, I think part of what helps in terms of, especially in terms of tracking the numbers and everything, is that before I worked in comics, well, it was while I was writing for Newsarama and stuff, I was working, my day job was as the accounts receivable clerk for a fashion designer. So for like a year and a half, my day job was dealing with QuickBooks and like invoices and all of that stuff. So I think that helps that my brain just sort of understands all of that.
Can I just say that that's a great premise for a romance comic, being in accounts receivable for a fashion designer?
Well, it was kind of a horrible place to work, but, you know.
Sorry.
No, it was just like it was the messiest office I've ever worked in. Like, every office was crammed full of like rolls of fabric, including mine. Like, they would just store random fabric everywhere, so I'd like trip in the hallways and stuff.
I imagine every office for every kind of business is like that. Like if you work for Hormel, there's just, you know, spam everywhere. Yeah.
I was about to say, like, you know, I've been to the Marvel offices, and they have, you know,
right.
long boxes and toys everywhere, but I like that you just went straight for canned chili, Matt.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the creative aspects of Fresh Romance, because you're so invested in the business side of things, and you know, you do have a group of very accomplished, really great creators working on the stories in the anthology. What was the collaboration there to bring this comic about? Did you just ask for pitches? Did you kind of have creators in mind going into it, and you knew what genre you wanted to cover, or how did it all come together?
It was sort of a mix of things. You know, I approached a lot of the writers first just because I knew a bunch of people that I thought would be interested. So Sarah Vaughn was the first person I approached because she and I had long conversations already about romance novels and romance comics and stuff. I knew this would be up her alley, and in fact, the response I got back was like all caps when I asked if she would be interested. And with her, because we had talked specifically about Regency romance in the past, and that's like when I read romance novels, I read a lot of Regency romance novels. I told her, like, you know, you can pitch me whatever you want, but just so you know, like, I want one of the stories to be a Regency romance. So if you want to write that, like, bring that pitch at me, too. She did, and I loved it. And then for her, like, we had to find a really specific artist that could, that would take the time to make sure it all looked historically accurate, because that was something that was really, really important to both Sarah and I. We knew readers would dismiss it if it wasn't what they wanted out of the genre. Sarah Searle fit that perfectly. With Sarah Kuhn's story, because Sarah's never written a comic before, you know, she pitched me a bunch of things, and I liked the one we went with the most. And I wanted to find her an artist that had a little more experience, because I knew she had never written a comic before, even though she knows a lot of people in comics and she knows how to write a script and she's a good writer. It's just to have that added advantage of an artist who has done this all before and who knows storytelling and stuff is really important. And by the same token, like, matching Ariel Javalanos with Kate Leff, who has written a ton of comics now and who is an artist herself, when this is Ariel's first published comics work, just sort of helps them communicate with each other and make sure, like, everybody is on the same page and the best possible story is being told. So with them, it was a lot more like me handpicking each person on the team and sort of putting teams together, and based on the writer's pitches, finding the artist that we both agreed would do the best job. With some of the stories that have gotten signed on since, it's been more like the writer saying, oh, I really want to work with this person, or talking to artists about what kind of stories they want to draw. And so it's a little more fluid. My feeling on it is, like, they all own the copyright to these stories. They own the stories 100%. I don't own any part of it. So at the end of the day, I want to make sure that they're doing a comic that they want to own. I obviously want to be happy with it because I'm publishing it and I'm paying for it. But I also want to make sure that they really believe in it too.
This is, Ariel, is it Javalanos?
Yeah, I think that's how I pronounce it now.
This is her first published comic?
Yeah.
That is amazing. Because the art in that story is phenomenally good. It is so good.
Yeah, she's really, really good.
And
she's still learning. Like, she'll even say, like, she's still honing her craft, which I think is really, really great, because she's just going to get better and better.
You mentioned earlier that you know, we're going to have that article on the fashions of vintage romance comics. And I think you know that I am a fan of vintage romance comics, although it is very much, it is maybe my one big ironic fandom. Because they're like, it's all just people crying and people like, no, I had to take her to the movie. She's my cousin, like, over and over. It's like, it's 50-year-old men making, you know, pretending to be 30-year-old women making comics for 14-year-old women. Like, it's
Sarah Vaughn collects vintage romance comics. She'll send me random panels that she scans that are just insane.
Oh yeah, I pushed hard. I couldn't do it this year, but I think the last 2 years at Comics Alliance, I pushed hard to do a romance comic every day in February, like a romance comic panel every day in February, just because they're so, like, they're so ridiculous. The art in School Spirit has that feel of like a Patsy Walker or a Katie Keene, where it has that focus on fashion. Like, all the characters' outfits are so meticulously designed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the skirts that are all at improbable angles to show off the pleats and folds. It's so, like, I love it. I love the art in that story.
I don't want to get too into, like, oh, women love fashion. Like, obviously that's not true, but it's something that I've talked to enough women in comics about. Like, you know, it's an endless frustration of reading, like, if you read superhero comics, when an artist will put a woman in, like, an outfit that nobody has worn since, like, 1983. You know, like, everybody wears the same outfit every day, and it's not their costume. Like, it's like every time you see them in plain clothes, they wear the exact same thing. And I think that's why, like, an artist... I mean, I think that's why people like Jamie McKelvey's art so much, is that he draws, you know, people, women and men, wearing clothes that they would realistically wear now. And that was something that really appealed to me and to Kate about Ariel Jovellanos, is she had a bunch of fashion sketches up on her blog, and we knew that was something that would really work well with these super popular, very, very rich girls, and making sure they looked just right. And but by the same token, Sally Jane Thompson, who's drawing the Ruby Equation, she also spent a lot of time on the fashion of the characters in that story, even though it's less fashion focused. And Sarah Kuhn sent notes and like style suggestions and stuff in the character designs to suggest this is what kind of person this is, and here's sort of what their style would be. And I think those character designs ended up really great. And then, like, just because apparently we're all obsessed with fashion, even the Ruin stuff is really fashion-focused. Like, we have a historical consultant for Ruin who we pay to make sure that all of the clothing and furniture and the carriages and everything is on point with 1804.
Well, that kind of leads me to something that I wanted to talk about with Fresh Romance, because there are three stories in the first issue, and I really enjoyed them all. I loved the lead story, the school spirit, quite a bit. I really enjoyed all the setup that goes on in Ruined, and Matt and I were both talking about how much we liked the Ruby Equation as well.
Yeah, the notion of I think they're aliens, right, that are matchmakers. Like, their whole thing is that they've got to be matchmakers to get to the next step in their jobs. Fantastic. I love it.
I think they might be Cupids.
Maybe they are Cupids. I like the uncertainty of it.
But they are three very different stories. I mean, School Spirit is very much a high school secret love story that turns supernatural on the last page. You know, the Ruby Equation is maybe aliens, maybe Cupids. It's very kind of sci-fi fantasy with a really fun premise. And then Ruined is sad British people getting married. And neither one of them are into that at all.
That is true.
But it's a nice little bit of variety. And I was wondering, like, was that something that was... I mean, obviously you wanted to focus all kinds of romance stories, but did you go about putting this first issue together being, you know, okay, we need, you know, a young romance, we need a period story, we need something that's a little more contemporary and comedic? Like, was that how ruthless were you in the business side of picking these three stories?
A lot of it was just what kind of stories the creators wanted to tell. Like I said, I suggested to Sarah Vaughan that I'd love to see a Regency romance. She pitched me a modern romance, too, but I really liked her concept for Ruined, so we went with that one. I just sort of told them, like, you know, this is what we want to do. Here are my rules, which, by the way, the rules are it has to be in 10-page increments and no penetration and no bodily fluids.
Those are some rules. I think those are the same rules that they... That's the Comics Code, right?
Yeah.
That was the Comics Code by the end of the 70s, I think.
Well, I was trying to make the point to everybody, like, you know, we're not erotica. The point of everything should be the romance, and, like, sex is a part of that, and that's fine. But I don't want to get too obscene. I sort of left it up to everyone, but as time has gone on and I've seen more and more pitches, you know, like, I was just talking to a creator who wants to write and draw her own story, and she was like, you know, is there anything specific you were looking for? And now it's to the point where I'm like, oh, well, I haven't seen any stories like this that are focused on this. And so I'm starting to see where the holes are in terms of what I think people would want to read in addition to all the other stuff that's in the works. Like the Jen Van Meter Kyle Latino story that's coming up is all about a group of friends who are seniors in college who are playing one last D&D game. And like, that's obviously going to appeal to a specific audience. I mean, I think everyone will enjoy it, but it's aimed at people who are into D&D and who understand the bond of tabletop gaming and everything. And so it's just been about curating a bunch of stories that can appeal to a lot of different people.
Is there anything built in about stories having kind of a genre twist to them? Because that's something I definitely noticed in the three stories in the first issue, is that certainly School Spirit sort of has the sense of it's going to be this teen love triangle or quadrangle story, and then there's a genre twist at the end. You know, the matchmaking Cupids or aliens, that's obviously a genre twist. And then there's a twist on Ruined. Like, there's a twist on that kind of romance, in that, you know, it's not about that longing that you see in so many Regency romance kinds of stories. It's
right.
quite the opposite. So is that something built in, or is that just kind of the result of wanting to see something different and interesting?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. I think it's just all these writers are familiar with the romance genre in novels and TV and movies and even in comics. And I think they all understood, as I was talking about the idea of fresh romance as modern romance comics and sort of modernizing this genre that even when it was coming out was sort of outdated, you know, like you said, like 50-year-old men writing like they were 30-year-old women. They all took that as, okay, let's see what we can do with that and make it sort of a little more interesting. And it's been great. I think it's really neat. And I think you're going to see in the future, we're going to have a little more straightforward stories, but we're also going to have some even quirkier, weirder stories.
I think I have one more question for you before we kick it over to our listeners on Twitter. When I think about the great anthologies of comics, you know, I think about your 2000 ADs, your Tales from the Crypts, and all of those have a thing in common, which is that the editor is a character who appears in the book to introduce the stories. And I'm not saying that you need to claim that you have come down from Beetlejuice to give us the gift of thrill power, although I would love to see that introduction in Fresh Romance number 2. But have you considered that? Have you considered a becoming the Rosie Press mascot?
I have not, and I think that would be horrifying.
Okay, well, if you can make that deal with Rosie Press,
I might do it. If I could look like the Crypt Keeper.
It would be great if the Crypt Keeper just showed up and was like, you know, I have more than one interest.
Here's,
I also like teens in love.
Here's what I'm suggesting. Talk to your lawyer about whether there's any legal way to use the likeness of Rosie Perez and then have her introduce every story. I think that's the ticket.
We could have her do signings.
Yeah.
Not that there are comics to sign, but...
Listen, Matt and I have done a lot of digital comics. Just offer to sign iPads. That's what we're doing. And with that, I think it's time we kick it over to our listeners to see if anyone has any questions for Janelle about Fresh Romance.
Yes.
Matt, if people want to get in on that, if people want to ask questions to our guests when we have these little chats every week, how can they go about that?
What they need to do is they need to go to change.org. And they need to start a petition asking the wonderful and talented Miss Rosie Perez to allow Rosie Press to use her likeness and image in all their comics in perpetuity going forward. Sign that petition, get hundreds of thousands of signatures, if not millions, to make that happen. Because that's the change we need to see in our world today. That's what I'm saying. And after you do that, go to twitter.com, sign up for an account, follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris. Wait until usually Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. That's when I actually asked for these questions. Sometimes we record on a different day, which is what we're doing right now. It's Friday. But either way, one of us will put out the call for questions sometime during the week, and that will be your opportunity to ask questions of our guest, like these questions you're about to hear for Janelle. And the first one I have is from our good friend, Ben Gully, Franz Ferdinand II, on Twitter. Ben asks, who is everyone's favorite comic book couple? Janelle, we'll start with you.
The easy response is Rogue and Gambit. They were my first favorite comic couple, and even though, you know, obviously they may not be a couple now, I don't know, it's been a while, but they're still my favorite.
Chris, I have a guess as to who you might say.
It's Scott and Barna.
That's what I thought.
And Big Barna, yeah.
I
will say, writing Rogue and Gambit has given me an entirely new appreciation for them, because they are they are very fun to write together. But yeah. Well, outside of Batman and Justice, it's going to be Scott and Barta.
Mine is very old fashioned, but I like them. It's Clark Kent and Lois Lane.
Look, like, they're pretty hard to beat.
They're two reporters in love. I can't fault that. I can't be mad at that. Our next question is from Barely Sushi, and look. You can answer this however you like. Barely Sushi asks, truly, what is the freshest romance? Similarly, what is the wackest?
I suppose that depends on how you define freshest.
I think the stories in Fresh Romance that take...
There you go. I like that answer.
What's the wackest romance? Do you have an answer for that one?
Whoever the Fresh Prince dated on the show.
Are you talking about?
Pretty whack.
What was her name? Nia Long. When he was in junior college.
But you are reaching for that reference, Matt. You went deep.
That's the girlfriend I remember most from Fresh Prince.
Matt, would you say that was wiggity whack or just the regular kind?
I think just regular whack.
Just regular whack.
They'd have to date crisscross for it to be wiggity whack. Tales to Enrage on Twitter has this question for Matt and Jangle. I think that means Janelle. I encountered autocorrect changing your name to Jangle earlier tonight.
Yes, that happened.
The question is, what is the wild animal you most want to for a pet, even though you know it's a terrible idea?
Oh, that's easy. A red panda. 100%. I would have a whole house full of red pandas hanging around with my cats if I could.
And folks, that was not an edit. That answer came to her that quickly.
Yeah, it was that fast.
Something that has been thought about.
I don't have an answer for that question, because a good 20% of my day is spent just telling my wife Marlene all the wild animals we cannot have as pets. Because they will murder us dead.
I think a tiger would also be cool.
See, you can't do that. Tigers are the most deadly. They will kill you.
Not the most. I mean, look, I'm just allergic to them, so they're very deadly to me. But
they're deadlier than lions. Tigers are mega deadly. All right. This is a question from Wednesday Question. We're getting into this territory now. I don't like it, but I'm going to ask it. I need something settled, and I hear you're the people to ask about this kind of thing. Are sandals shoes?
is this what we do now? Just words that sound like sandwich? Is this what we do now?
In your opinion, are sandals shoes?
Yes, because pretty much anything with a sole that goes on your foot is a shoe.
This is a question from Arthur Wyatt.
Arthur Wyatt knows about Thrill Power.
Coming yeah, he knows a few things about thrill power. Outside of presumably romance, what genre or subgenre of non-superhero comics most needs a comeback?
I would say, like, crime comics. I mean, there are some that exist, but I think, like, as a big thing, seeing more crime comics would be awesome.
Yeah,
I agree, especially if those crime comics also have a sci-fi edge to them. Kind of a retro pulpy sci-fi crime comic.
Like, what if the detective was a robot?
Like, what if you could go to Kickstarter.com and put some money down on that idea today?
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Okay. This is from RomCom Your Mom on Twitter. This is a question for all of us as well. RomCom manga is popular here. I assume they're in Japan. But not U.S. RomCom comics, with some exception. Why is that, you think? I think they're asking why are there not American romantic comedy comics?
Well, because American people hate fun and love.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are a lot of factors going back to about 1954 about the dominance of superhero comics. It's late. I'm tired. Matt was yawning earlier.
It's true.
But yeah, like, I think, you know, I think you see the difference between American comics and manga is that manga culture kind of evolved without those kind of necessary, you know, not necessarily having those restrictions that were sort of imposed on comics from outside to make superheroes a dominant genre.
Well, and manga took girls seriously as an audience. And so, you know, over the years has catered to them just as much as they catered to boys and men, which the U.S. market hasn't done.
Well, and add to that a weird hesitation among American comics publishers, not just about romance, but also about comedy. Comedy comics, I've been pushing for years for more comedy comics. And people just seem to be weird about it. I don't know.
And if anybody wants to read a good one, My Love Story with 2 exclamation points is available digitally from Viz right now. And I wrote a review of it for Comics Alliance not too far back. And until Fresh Romance, it was my favorite romance comic of the year. So definitely check out My Love Story. Not to be confused with the classic Marvel romance comic of the same name, which is frequently very bad.
James Harmon asked us if an open-faced sandwich is a sandwich, and I'm not even going to dignify that with an answer.
I hope you're happy, Charlotte. I hope you're happy.
Well,
listening to this
debacle. Charlotte of Oz does have a question for us that does not have to do with sandwiches. And the question is, what are the pitfalls of the romance genre that you want this anthology to avoid?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I would say getting, particularly the pitfalls of, like, romance comics in the history of the industry. I don't want to get too into the, like, tearjerker, super soapy, dramatic stuff. Like, I would rather all the fresh romance stories focus on the romance and the fun and everything and not be about, like, he stood me up for my sister and tears and, you know. I don't think that's as fun and entertaining if it ever was fun and entertaining.
Joseph Montague, Bros of Lost Nerds on Twitter, has flipped the script on us and
that
wants to know.
Sounds like a Mad Max name.
What's the worst couple in comic books ever?
What about Scott Summers and Madeline Pryor?
That's
a pretty rough one because, you know, because she looks just like his dead ex-girlfriend.
She's literally a clone of his dead ex.
And then he just leaves her in Alaska, like, when his dead ex-girlfriend comes back. Like, did they, I guess we should ask Rachel and Miles, did they ever actually get divorced?
I think that's...
Is marriage to clones legal, though? Are clones people?
Oh, we're getting into more hair-splitting conversations. I don't like it.
I've just been holding my back because I got both of you beat.
Worst
of all time, Donna Troy and Terry Long.
Oh, of course. Of course.
Worst of all time.
That's just because Terry Long is the worst.
He's yes. Somebody reminded me, I hadn't seen it in a while, and I think it's actually, I scanned it and put it on my blog ages ago, the issue of Who's Who that's all about the supporting characters. Like, they have all the superheroes in, like, 1 through 12 or however many there were, and then there's an appendix that has all the supporting characters, and the cover is everybody at, like, a barbecue, like, you know, like a pool party, basically, and Terry Long standing there in a like a collared shirt, a sweater, and a Speedo eating hamburgers. And I'm like, this is the least appealing thing. This is the least appealing image in the world.
All right, this is going to have to be our last question. This is from Super Geek Mike on Twitter. And this is for everybody. What's your favorite romantic comedy? I have an immediate answer. It's kind of a dude answer, but I'm a dude. High Fidelity is my favorite
really?
Comedy. Yeah.
That is a dude answer.
Yeah.
That is a dude answer. Okay, look, genuinely, if you want the honest answer, it's Love Actually, but it's only the part, only Liam Neeson's kid's part. Because I find the line, "Let's go get the shit kicked out of us by love," to be one of the best lines ever written.
Hey, the Bill Nighy part of that movie is pretty great too.
The Bill Nighy part is really good. The Keira Knightley part is terrible.
It's the worst.
And the part with what's his name? The Hobbit. What's his name?
Martin Freeman.
Martin Freeman. The part with Martin Freeman's really cute. Yeah, so it's like 3 out of 5 segments, or 3 out of 7 segments of Love Actually is my favorite rom-com. The others can just not be in that movie. Janelle, do you have a favorite?
Well, now I'm pissed because you took my answer, because I was also going to say Love Actually.
Did I really?
So it's completely ridiculous, and I think it's to blame for the rash of, like, New Year's Eve and Valentine's Day movies.
Oh, yeah, that's the movie you could definitely point the finger at for all of those.
Yeah.
Gary Marshall's late career is entirely dependent on Love Actually.
I mean, also, it is unsurprising that my favorite romantic comedy is the one that ends with the voice of Marceline the Vampire Queen singing All I Want for Christmas Is You. Like, that's very much a Chris Sims pick, I think.
Oh, wait, you know what? I actually recently added a new favorite. Austin Land.
Okay.
Love Actually was my favorite for a long time, but I love Austin Land. I just saw it, like, a couple months ago.
That's about, like, a Jane Austen theme park?
Yeah, it's about Carrie Russell goes to a house where she gets to live as, like, an Austen-type character, and things are horribly ridiculous, and there is a great video on YouTube of her playing Hot in Her on the piano and singing it, which is one of my favorite things ever.
I thought you were making a joke, Matt. I did not realize that was the actual premise of the movie.
Nope, that's the movie.
It's way better than the premise suggests, because I put off seeing it for a long time, because I was like, this has to be super stupid. And then it was on cable, and I was like, oh my god, I love this so much.
Thank you so much for coming on, Janelle. Before we let you go, please let all our listeners know all the many, many places that they can find you on the internet.
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at Nelly, and also you can find the Rosie Press Twitter at Rosie Press. I am the senior editor of ComicsAlliance.com, and the Rosie Press site is rosiepress.com, where you can buy comics and check out other stuff.
All right, well, Janelle, thank you so much. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks once again to Janelle. You can grab Fresh Romance at Comixology. You can grab it directly from Rosie Press. If you were a Kickstarter backer, you can take your choice of how you want to get it. But for now, Matt and I are going to switch gears a little bit and add things to our ongoing list of the best quotes in comics history. That's right, it's the 100 best. It's the World Heavyweight Champions.
That's right. This is where we are assembling a list of the top 100 comics quotes of all time. And before we get to our first list, a correction. On our all quotes episode from 2 weeks ago, We mistakenly said that the "no one dies" quote is from a Mark Waid issue of The Flash. It is, in fact, from a Bill Messner Loeb's issue of The Flash.
William Messner Loeb's, an underrated Flash writer, even by us.
That's right.
Also, while we're doing corrections, I got an email a couple weeks ago that just said JFK is also in Queens.
That's a movie fighter's correction.
That is a movie fighter's correction. Apologies. I, honest to God, did not think it was in Queens. I had to go look it up.
All right. Now that we've gotten our corrections out of the way, we have a list from Pedro Piquer, who is a line stepper. And these are all famous first quotes from characters' first appearances.
Interesting. Interesting.
The first one is from X-Men number 1 by Professor X. To me, my X-Men.
Very much conflicted in this regard. That is a quote I recently, Chad and I recently put that into a comic we're writing. So clearly I'm a fan of it. It also means nothing. But I feel like it's a good quote, and it's a quote that, you know, it's very Silver Agey. It's very much one of those, you know, people don't talk like that kind of quotes. But it has come back in really interesting ways. Like, doesn't it come back in the Joss Whedon, John Cassidy run? Like,
it does.
Like, when Cyclops puts on his Grant Morrison jacket and shoots somebody with a gun and then goes to meet my X-Men, that's pretty fucking badass.
But it's a quote that implies ownership in a way that I'm not comfortable with.
Well, I mean, look, he is the X in X-Men. I mean, he says he's not, but he is.
I mean, I guess you could say it's like, to me, my students. But, I don't know, it feels a little bit like Professor X is just saying, like, hey, I own you guys.
Well, also, when he says that, they are literally his students, too.
Yes. So where do you think we're going to put it? I think it's not to the level of Professor X is a jerk.
I mean, I don't even know if that should be on the list, is the thing. Like, yeah, I know we've only got 47 on here, and we're going for the top 100.
It's probably at least above Criminals or a Superstitious Cowardly Lot.
Yeah, I think we can put it there.
Right above that.
It is not as good as Back to Cop School.
No, I don't think so either. Okay. The next one on Pedro's list is, face it, Tiger, you just hit the jackpot. Mary Jane Watson from Amazing Spider-Man number 42.
One of the all-time greats.
So good. But also, a really weird thing to say.
Like, there's like three weird things about that. One is that it is Stan Lee writing teens, which is always the best.
Yes.
Two, the, you know, people I don't know, unless you go back and read those first, you know, 100 issues of Spider-Man, which highly recommended, by the way, they hold up.
They sure do.
I don't think people remember how great the Mary Jane introduction is. Because it goes on forever of Aunt May. It's Aunt May and her equally old lady neighbor
Aunt
trying
Anna.
To set Peter up with her niece.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's May Parker and Anna Watson trying to set their kids up together. And there's like a long running thing where Peter's like, oh, she's going to be a monster.
Yeah.
She's going to be some, you know, complete weirdo, which, by the way, no, Peter, you're the weirdo.
Peter, you're no prize yourself.
Yeah. I mean, by the time Mary Jane shows up, those are John Romita issues, so he has grown up and filled out.
He looks better, that's true.
Yeah. But, you know, you were a Steve Ditko character for a little while, Peter. You shouldn't be so shallow. But, yeah, but, you know, the whole running gag of Peter not wanting to be set up with, and if you look at it charitably, he just doesn't want his 80-year-old aunt setting him up on a date, you know, with some girl that he doesn't know and that he doesn't think he has anything in common with. And then when that door opens and it's John Romita Mary Jane Watson.
Yeah.
face it, Tiger.
It's a punchline. It's a punchline more than anything.
It's a punchline, but it's a punchline that's also super revealing about Mary Jane's character. Because Mary Jane knows that this is going on. She, like, Unless I'm misremembering, and you might know better than I do, because I know you're the Spider-Man guy between the two of us, but we see, like, Mary Jane in silhouette, or in shadow at times, when she's like, oh, you just missed, you know, Peter's not home. Like, so she knows he's been dodging her.
Yeah.
And she knows what she looks like.
Yes. I mean, I think there's a reading of that line that's, like, very, like, male-gazy, a character talking basically as a thought balloon for another character.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a reading of that, of just like Mary Jane is super confident. She's attractive and she knows it. And this is her way of saying that. She's also getting real familiar real fast.
I love Mary Jane's confidence in that, like, I mean, look, I am a Mary Jane guy. I always liked her more than I like Gwen. Like, I like her more than I like Black Cat. I like Mary Jane a lot. And a lot of it is that she is super confident, like, day one. And also the idea, you know, it's the Jerry Conway idea, the Kurt Busiek idea, that she knows he's Spider-Man from day one. Like, well, day one of him being Spider-Man.
She saw him go, like, crawling up the window and taking his mask off. That's the retcon explanation for that.
And that she goes, hey, you're Spider-Man, I know what your deal is, and, you know, and I am the best thing that's ever going to happen to you. And she's right. Yeah. She's completely right. Like, you don't, like, Gwen's introduction in retrospect is really weird, because Gwen's introduction is a Steve Ditko thing that it's a weird science nerd meet cute, where she's, you know, like, Steve Ditko Gwen does not look like John Romita Gwen. And I don't mean just, like, in appearance, but, like, John Romita draws Gwen as a happy-go-lucky go-go dancer. And Steve Ditko draws Gwen as a beautiful scientist, like, right, a beautiful nerd.
Right.
And so you get, like, the introductions of Peter Parker's two greatest loves very close together. It's, you know, it's towards the end of Ditko's run where Gwen shows up, and Romita hasn't been on that long when Mary Jane shows up. You know, they're his, you know, they're his Betty and Veronica. The introductions are so, they're such a great contrast to each other. But, like, a Steve Ditko character, you know, like, even though Stan's doing the dialogue, a Steve Ditko character never says, face it, Tiger, you just hit the jackpot. A John Romita character does.
Yeah, no Steve Ditko character has that level of confidence.
Yeah, they're all full of self-loathing.
Okay, so where do we put it on the list? I know, I mean, it definitely goes on the list.
Yeah, I think, like, so much good stuff, like Mary Jane's confidence, Mary Jane's, like, so much Mary Jane stuff comes out of that. Also, I love the idea that she calls him Tiger, and I love that has been a thing that has stuck.
That's what I was saying. She was getting real familiar about, like,
yeah, that's her pet name for him today.
The first time she meets him, she's got a pet name for him.
Also, the way that it came back in Spider-Gwen was really great too.
Yes, I mean, well, the quote itself, the way it came back in Spider-Gwen,
yeah,
like, top 20.
I mean, I would put it above. You should have brought more Thors. I don't know if I would put it above Darkseid is.
Okay, so in between there we have, it was a nice piece of work, you should have signed it.
We got real excited about that one.
We did. We've got, if you knew how much you were loved, no, not one of you would raise your hand and rage again. I think that was pretty good. And then Ultron, we would have words with thee. I think it might go right above the Ultron quote.
Yeah, I think that's a good place for it. That is a good place.
One last one from Pedro, and this may have to wrap us up. Another X-Men quote, another one you have used recently. Welcome to the X-Men, Kitty Pride. Hope you survived the experience.
Oh, it's the best.
Yeah, it's great.
It's the best. That's the fun thing about Chris Claremont being on that book for 15 years, that he keeps getting to use that stuff until it becomes a thing.
Yeah.
And that line is a thing, and that line is, like, one of my favorite things.
And what's crazy about the X-Men, like, that's not just a joke. She could really die.
Yeah, like, people die on their first days as X-Men. That is a thing that happens. It's a terrible school.
How does that school stay open? How is the state of New York not shut that down? Is that, like, top 10 material? Is that above that awesome thing quote, or are you still alone at Galabru?
No. I mean, look, obviously not. But I do think it goes above Try the Red One. I think it might be number 10 on the list right now.
Okay. Try the Red One has taken a real beating.
Look, Try the Red One is great. It's also up against 70 years of comics that came before it.
Fair enough. Okay, that's going to slot in at number 10. Pedro, thank you for that list. We only got one in this week, but we are 250 quotes. And it's June 1. So I think we're doing all right. Think we're on track.
Yep, that's it. We're not even halfway through the year, but we are at halfway through the list. Now, we have said before, these bottom three or four. Wait, how did okay, suckers, you took your best shot. Now it's my turn. How is that number 48 on this list?
I don't know. It's how it happened.
I'm going to have to go back and listen to that one. I think you might have changed that one.
I did not change it.
Listen, we use that one too.
Thanks for sending in that list, Pedro. If you would like to send us a list for the World Heavyweight Champions, you can do so at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send us listener questions and comments. You can also send us listener questions, the ones that we answer on the show, on Tumblr at warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. Also, go to our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you will find the World Heavyweight Champion list and the Every Story Ever list. You can also stream the show, read show notes, leave comments, and download the show on that very website. Check us out on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and you search for War Rocket Ajax, that's where you'll find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the more we are featured on iTunes, which is good news. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson. You'll find links to all my stuff, including Copernicus Jones Robot Detective, and ways that you can buy that digitally. And hopefully soon, you will have a way to acquire that in print if our Kickstarter is successful. Chris, where can everybody find all your stuff?
Everybody can find all of my stuff in at about.me/ChrisSims. That's ChrisSims. There will be links there to my Twitter, my Tumblr, and my author page on Comixology, where you can go and buy X-Men 92. It's coming out bi-weekly, digitally, and it'll be out in print next month. But the first chapter is available now for $1.99. If you have bought it already, thank you so much for supporting that. I cannot tell you how much I genuinely appreciate that, and also how much Matt and I appreciate you supporting the show and the stuff that we do. It really does mean a lot to me. So please check that stuff out. This has been War Rocket Ajax. Oh, I've been so good, Matt. I've been so good.
256.
We will be back next week with a returning guest. I'm not gonna spoil it, but she will be back to have a really fun conversation with us.
And it'll be my birthday.
Oh, Matt, I figured out what I'm getting you for your birthday this year, by the way.
I'm excited.
I hope I can still get it. If I can't, I'm gonna have to come up with something else and I'll just tell you, but I know what I'm gonna get you for your birthday. It's going to be useless for you. I'm very excited.
Great.
Just for the record, Matt and I will both be at HeroesCon in Charlotte in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, about 3 weeks
from this recording. A little more than 2 weeks.
So come out and say hello, and have a great week, everybody. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah. Flash.
I'm not going to ask the bagel question. I'm not asking that one, but I'm asking our sandal shoes. The bagel
question made me so angry.
We got asked.
It's patently ridiculous.
Detour for 1 second. Leesk asked us if a bagel with cream cheese is a sandwich. We're not answering
ridiculous.
That one.
I'm sorry, James. That is ridiculous.
Janelle,